I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Now, I love my smartphone, and I pretty much carry it wherever I go. It keeps me plugged into my family and friends and, frankly, work. It also connects me to a world of ideas and entertainment, and it lets me check in on my little grandson, Max, as he learns to navigate his world. But I also get concerned about how I can hardly resist picking up my phone when I hear it beep, and when I answer it, it's usually unimportant. Now, I can put it down for hours at a time, and I do not consider myself addicted, but I am hooked. Our guest Nir Eyal wrote a book a few years ago titled Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Devices. He worked with companies designing irresistible products about how they work on us psychologically, a form of mind control, if you will. He's also blogged about how consumers, the rest of us, can manage our daily digital distractions, information overload, and learn to control our gadgets rather than be controlled by them. He blogs at nearandfar.com. And Nir Eyal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Do you love your smartphone?
I do love my smartphone. I have to admit, I do really enjoy using it. At times, I use it too much. They say that research is me-search, and so a lot of what I do today is trying to figure out why these devices are so persuasive and how we can put them in their place.
Well, they are, and some are better than others. You have written about this hook. There's the trigger, the action, the reward, and the investment. Walk us through that.
Absolutely. So the book was written not for the companies that typically people think of as habit-forming products or even addictive products like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp and Slack and Snapchat. They already know these techniques, right? I didn't write the book for them. What I wanted to do was to write a book so that everybody else, right, the people who are building apps in their basement or in a garage in Silicon Valley, that these folks who are building products that can actually improve people's lives, that can help people do things that they want to do if they would just use the technology. Because if we think about it, you know, most tech products out there, they don't suck us in, not in the way that Facebook and Twitter might. They just suck, right?
They're just not very good, right?
Yeah, they're awful, right? Most technology out there, websites, apps out there, they're horrible, and most of them fail. So my goal was to say, look, how can we learn from these companies that are so good at changing user behavior? What can we take out of those companies in terms of lessons so that lots of companies can build better products and services? So what I found in my research was that these companies that I just described, these world-changing companies like the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagrams and WhatsApp, et cetera, they all have the same core pattern built into the design of the product. And that's what I call the hook. And the hook is these four basic steps that you mentioned, the trigger, the action, the reward, and the investment. And it's by sending folks through these cycles of these four steps, this is how habits are formed.
Because it is satisfying, because at every step we get a little deeper or gives us some kind of a feedback that makes us feel good, kind of like that rat in the maze.
Well, it's that we're learning, right? That it's nothing more than that. Habits are just a type of learned behavior. And these products are really good at changing user behavior by quickly forming these habits. And what the ultimate goal of a habit-forming product is to satisfy a user need, right? Now, if we dig a little deeper, there's always some psychology to that deeper user need. There's usually a pain point, some kind of negative emotion, what psychologists call a negative valence state. In fact, there was a study a few years ago that found that people suffering from depression check email more. Right? Because they experience these negative valence states more often than the rest of the population. But, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, we all do this, right? We all use products and services for one reason, and that is to modulate our mood, to feel something different. So what a habit-forming product does is to attach itself to that negative emotion. So if you're feeling lonely, you check Facebook. If you're uncertain, you Google. If you're bored, you check YouTube or the news or whatever to satisfy that boredom.
I'm also thinking of the other side of that emotion, that you can do all those things and get even more depressed or angry or anxious or upset, because again, there's a world of information and ideas and opinions out there.
Right. And this is really where I got interested in this topic, was not only how do we build habit-forming products so that we can help people do the things they want to do, like save money, exercise more. I mean, how great would the world be if we could use the same psychological hacks that Facebook is using to help people live better lives? And you know what? There are hundreds, if not thousands, of companies that are doing just that. Many of them I'm lucky enough to be an investor in. When I see a company that uses habits for good, I want to, you know, pounce on that opportunity, and I invest in these companies. And there's lots and lots of them. Now, What we are finding, though, is that there's, you know, to every technology, there's a downside. Paul Virilio said this great quote, and he said, when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. And before him, Sophocles, 2,500 years ago, the Greek philosopher said that nothing vast enters the life of mortals without a curse. Every technological revolution has bad sides, right? The agricultural revolution gave us all kinds of bad things. The industrial revolution gave us pollution and car accidents, etc. So, of course, we are going to have some downsides to this latest technological revolution that we are now seeing and we are coping with. And so I think, you know, part of becoming media literate in this new age is understanding how to extract the good aspects of these technologies while doing away with the bad aspects.
I mentioned rats in a maze, and I remember being in college and studying Skinner and learning that what was described as intermittent reinforcement is the hardest behavior to extinguish, that you get reinforced just enough so that when you hear that beep on your phone, and chances are it's not anything of any interest, you're still going to go there.
Right. So variable rewards are really at the heart of not only digital devices, but many different products that we find very engaging. The way that variable rewards work is this, that we know that when a reward is given on a intermittent schedule of reinforcement, so you open up an app and you're not quite sure what you're going to see, right? What did people post? What do the comments say? How many likes do I get? There's all this variability that keeps us checking. It makes us curious about what we might find next. You know, even before social media, I mean, email is the mother of habit-forming technology, right? We constantly want to see what do people send us? Sometimes you open up an email and it's something amazing happened, and other times it's something terrible happened. That variability keeps us checking. By the way, we see this everywhere, right? Of course, we see it in casinos, right? We see it in slot machines. That's what keeps people
reinforcing,
gambling.
Exactly. Yes,
variable
winning
rewards.
And losing.
We also see it in the news, right? And when we turn on the TV, it's a story, right? The first three letters of news is new. It's what's different, what happened, what changed. Now, that may not actually be useful or the most important thing that we have to deal with in our life, but we're interested because it's variable. It changes. Sports, when it comes to spectator sports, why are we interested in watching a ball bounce up and down a field? Is because of the uncertainty. The game isn't as fun once you know who won. So variable rewards are everywhere. But I think these companies, when it comes to our devices, have really done an amazing job of engineering that variability so that it keeps us engaged. Doesn't mean we can't stop, but we need to be aware that that's what's going on.
And I do want to get to the stopping part, but I just scribbled down the words novelty and narcissism. I mean, that you know, we like to know about ourselves. We like to see ourselves, if not writ large, certainly that other people are responding to us.
Absolutely.
Is that what it is? Novelty just keeps us plugged in?
Right. So it's a social reward. It's what I call rewards of the tribe. So there's three types of variable rewards: rewards of the tribe, rewards of the hunt, and rewards of the self. Rewards of the tribe are these things that feel good that come from other people. So the search for community, competition, empathetic joy, feeling good because someone else feels good. All of these are forms of social rewards that come from other people and have this variability. By the way, romance is all about this, right? When you're in a relationship in the beginning, you get those butterflies in your stomach. It's interesting. But then if you've been married to somebody for years and years, those butterflies kind of go away when the novelty fades. You love each other for other reasons, but the variability isn't as much there. And then you have rewards of the hunt, which is all about the search for material possessions or information. So the casino example. And then you have rewards of the self, which is around mastery, completion, competency. It's why we love checking boxes on our to-do list. It's why we love getting to the next level in a game. All of those things are variable. They feel good, and they keep us engaged.
You have written about what you do in your own life to manage all this technology and all the bells and whistles, the novelty, the narcissism. How does your day, how is it constructed?
Yeah, so there's a few things. So I've actually, I write just as much today about how to build habit-forming products as I do about how to break bad habits. So just to be very clear, I'm not a proponent of any one technology. Facebook has never paid me a dollar. I've never worked for Google. I don't have any vested interest in these companies. I mean, if they don't serve you, stop using them, right? Uninstall them. And I think that's the critical question we have to start with asking ourselves. Is this media serving me or am I serving it? That's the critical question. And I don't care if that medium is Facebook or watching too much news or watching too many sports or whatever it might be. Is it serving me or am I serving it? And so what I've had to do is a few things, and this is actually what I'm working on for my next book, is all about how do we do the things we say we want to do, right? That's you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it's distracting you from. So when people say to me, oh, you know, Facebook, God, it's so distracting. I can't stop. It's addictive. I say, well, what is it distracting you from, right? What else was on your agenda? And then they hand me their phone. They show me their calendar. There's nothing there, right? They haven't planned anything
to replace it,
right? So it's, you know, I think that's a very important thing we need to consider, that if, you know, if Zuckerberg decides tomorrow, I'm shutting off Facebook, I'm done, I've made enough money, it's not that people would suddenly start, you know, reading Shakespeare and Chaucer. They would find other distractions unless they are mindful about how they want to spend their time.
But it sounds like you can correct me if I'm wrong. You construct your mornings so that you're not on Facebook. You're kind of keeping your digital devices at bay and living your life and doing the things that you need to do. And then you use those technologies later on in the day.
Exactly. So I schedule my day. And I think this is something that I think we all need to realize in this day and age, is that if you don't schedule your time, someone else will. And so if you don't plan out, and I plan it down to the half-hour increments my entire day.
Really?
Yeah. And so in the morning, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I have the same routine that when I'm in town, when I'm out of town, you know.
All bets are off.
Exactly.
Right?
Habits are specific to the environment.
Right.
But when I'm at home, I have the same routine. I don't use technology in the morning. I do my writing first thing in the morning. That's the hardest thing in my day and the most important thing that I have to do. So that's my top priority, professionally speaking. So I tune out distraction. I turn off these notifications during certain times of the day. And frankly, I use technology to help eliminate the bad aspects of technology. So for example, on my phone, there's this very simple little app called Forest that every time I start a writing session, and writing's hard. Many times when I write, I want to, you know, just Google something real quick or check an email real quick or look at Instagram real quick. And then, you know, half an hour later, I've wasted my writing time. So instead, I installed this app called Forest, which as soon as you open the app, it's just basically this virtual tree that with one button, you plant the tree, and if you go do anything else on your phone, the tree dies. Now, this sounds stupid. This sounds simple. Big deal. It's a virtual tree. Who cares? But it's that little bit of friction that makes me more mindful to ask myself, wait a minute, do I really need to be doing this right now?
Do I want to kill a digital tree?
Exactly. So as good as, you know, these companies, these big tech companies are brain hacking, as some people call it, there are so many things that we can do, like these simple apps, like turning off notifications to keep the technology in its place.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Nir Eyal. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Devices. And as he just mentioned, he's working on a new book to help us all deal with our devices and our habits. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Much to talk about. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How do you live with your gadgets? Let us know. Give us a call. Send us an email. Send us a Twitter. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. How often do you look at or check your smartphone during the day, checking Facebook or Twitter or even posting on Instagram? Again, Nir Eyal is our guest. He wrote a book a couple of years ago, and I will give you the actual correct title. It's called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and he blogs at Near and Far, and he has worked as a business consultant. Let me ask you about, you know, your book is Hooked, and it's about habit-forming devices. When does a habit become an addiction?
Yeah, and I appreciate you pointing out the distinction that habits and addictions are not the same thing. An addiction is a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user, whereas a habit, you know, we have good habits as well as bad habits. And so the idea behind the book is that I want to teach companies, product makers, app makers to build the kind of products that can improve people's lives. That's really the goal of this book. But that, you know, sometimes for some folks, products can become addictions. And let's be honest, you know, people get addicted to all sorts of things, not just technology. People can, you know, we call people who consume too much news. We think, you know, consuming news is about being an aware citizen. We call people who consume too much news news junkies. We call people who watch too much television couch potatoes. Right? There's lots of things that people can do that are extremes, that where they overconsume. And it turns out for the folks who are actually addicted, meaning, you know, an addiction is not, I like to use something a lot. An addiction isn't sometimes I even regret how much I use that particular distraction, so to speak. An addiction is something that even when you want to stop doing, you can't.
Interferes with your life.
Right. It has to cause harm. It has to cause harm. So that's the first question, is what harm is this doing? And then you know, what we want to do is to try and figure out how we can deal without that technology. Are we capable of coping without that particular distraction? So what I recommend to folks is the first thing to do is to schedule time for it, right? So that much of the harm that we see from technology today is that it interferes with what we really want to be doing. I found that when I wanted to spend time with my beautiful 9-year-old girl, once in a while I would take out my phone and I would start looking at Twitter or social media.
And maybe get sucked in a little
right.
bit.
Right. And that, frankly, wasn't good for me. I wanted to be present and I wasn't. So I wanted to see if I was actually addicted or if this was a personal responsibility issue and I needed to find a way around it. So what I did was I uninstalled Twitter from my phone. I still use it, but I schedule time for it. So every evening I have 1 hour for social media, but only at my desktop, because at my desktop there's no harm. That's what that time is meant for, not when I'm with my daughter at the park, but at my desktop. So I schedule time for social media. Then I remove the triggers. So I removed the app from my phone, but I also changed the notification settings on my phone. You know, 2/3 of smartphone owners never change their notification settings. That's crazy, right? We've got to take at least, you know, it only takes maybe 15, 20 minutes to go to your phone notification settings and stop all those apps from bothering you on their schedule. Only keep the ones that serve you, not the ones that you're serving. And then, you know, if that still doesn't help, then we have to dig deeper. And what we often find with addiction is that it's not just about the substance, the product, the technology in this case. There's something else. Right. We have to ask ourselves
a need that exactly. we have that's about more about us than the technology.
That's right. That's right. That addictions are always about an escape from an uncomfortable reality. And whether that addiction device is booze or heroin or technology or games, it's always about escape. Right. So if it really is to the point where we can't stop, even when we want to, there's always something deeper going on there that we need to spend some time analyzing.
Let me quote something you said. You said the confluence of increased access and greater sharing of personal information and at higher transmission speeds has created the perfect storm of addictive technology. So while, yes, there are certainly addictions to things that have nothing to do with technology, the way it's being designed does seem to feed some of those risks for addiction.
Right. If you don't schedule your time, someone else will.
Right.
And because today we have access to these amazing technologies, which do a lot of good, right? I love the fact that I can access the world's information with this device in my pocket. But that also means that if I'm looking for a place to escape, right? The holidays are coming. And I know every holiday when I have to get together with a bunch of family members I don't feel like seeing, and everybody's kind of shuffling around their feet and we don't know what to talk about. It's kind of uncomfortable. And the devices come out. Why? Because we're looking for an escape. And the access to that escape makes it so that if you have a predilection for addiction, or if you're looking to be somewhere else, you know, brain-wise, if not physically, there is a lot of companies out there who are ready and willing to help you escape. Doesn't mean we can't do something about it, but there are because there is more access to us, we have greater ability to escape.
Let me ask you about focus. This is something that you have looked at or paying attention to things and what our brain is doing. And on the one hand, it seems the brain has to pay attention, so it's focusing in on something, but then it has to ignore everything else. And I think for many of us, and I'm sitting here talking to you with the TV on right over over your shoulder there, there is so much stuff that wants to grab our attention that sometimes it's hard to pay attention.
Right. And it's interesting because the metaphor that I like to compare technology to this day, and I'm not the first one to do this, is cigarettes. in that you know, when you find a group of smokers, one person will take out their pack and they'll take out their lighter, and then it becomes a trigger for other people to do the same. And now all the smokers are lighting up, right? And the same happens with cell phones. We're sitting around the dinner table. Someone takes their device out, and soon everybody thinks it's a good time to take out their devices. And that's terrible, right? That's not a good thing, especially when we decided we want to be together. So again, it's about intentionality. There's nothing necessarily bad about these devices, that we're using them in a way that harms us, that doesn't serve us. So the good news is that, you know, we've made a lot of progress to stop smoking in this country. Now, some of that was because of legislation. A lot of it was because of legislation.
Because you can't smoke in this
right.
building,
there
for
are
instance.
Laws. But if you actually dig deeper, what we find is that something happened in the home, which is very interesting. So when I grew up, I remember, you know, in the early 80s, my father quit smoking, and yet we had ashtrays all over the house. And we had ashtrays because back then, when someone came over, it was unthinkable to ask them to go outside to smoke. Now, my mom had a little trick. She actually had an ashtray that was in the shape of a skeleton's hand. And if you wanted to smoke, you had to put your ashes.
Well done,
right?
I say, yes.
But it was rude to ask somebody, hey, go outside if you want to smoke back then. Look, today, I don't own ashtrays. Nobody would even imagine smoking in my house. That would be a ridiculous question to ask these days. And the smoking rate has gone from 42% in 1965 to about 16% today. And in large part, that is because it's become unacceptable in the home to smoke. And that there's no laws that made that so, right? People just made it culturally unacceptable that if you come to somebody's house, you wouldn't dream of smoking in their house, certainly without asking. Of course, maybe they're smokers, but most people say you want to smoke, go outside. That was something that we created what's called a social antibody, right? We saw that there is harm to a behavior, and we decided collectively that that was an inappropriate behavior. And so, you know, it's interesting. The people who are so-called digital natives, younger folks who have grown up in a world where they've never known a world without devices, I find, you know, I taught at Stanford for many years, and I find that those folks have an easier time that with their devices than older folks. It's fascinating because they've had more time to generate these rules and manners. Now, it's interesting. They have these rules and manners with each other. They treat their parents completely different. That's a whole nother story. But basically, it's about these social antibodies, these norms and manners, to make it unacceptable to say, hey, look, you know, we're here to be together. Let's put our phones away. Let's put them in a basket somewhere, or let's not take them out.
That is so fascinating because I've seen with my son, who's in his mid-30s, and his friends and his wife's friends, a kind of fluidity with their devices that as an older person who didn't grow up on this, didn't even have a TV when I grew up, yeah. that it's a different kind of relationship. And I am a lot probably clunkier dealing with the fluidity of what you do with your device if you have it.
It's fascinating.
Or don't have it.
So my father's a perfect case study here. So when he grew up, there was one telephone in his entire little village.
In the hall?
Not even in the village.
Oh,
it was
okay.
When someone called, it was always long distance. It was very expensive. And so if a phone rang, you picked it up. You would never not pick up a phone. Well, today, 2017, we're sitting together. We're having a deep conversation. And if that phone rings, he still can't not pick it up. So he'll interrupt our conversation because that habit has been ingrained in him from childhood, 70 years ago, about what the technology is for and how we have to respond to this technology. And so that's a very hard habit to change. So I have to beg him, please just let it go to voicemail. Whereas for me, if I was having a conversation with somebody, I would never pick up the device unless it was an absolute emergency.
I remember doing an interview about the telephone, and I was thinking about that center hall phone that I certainly grew up with, the one phone in the house, and everyone could hear everyone else's conversations. But the warnings at that time was that the telephone is going to ruin families because it's going to ring and someone's going to jump up from the dinner table and go answer it.
Right. And you know, this is a very, very common pattern. We see this with every new technology, right? All the way back to Aristotle saying that the written word was a technology that we did not want to propagate because it will make people feeble and lazy, that they won't have to remember things. So we don't want to teach people how to write them down. And of course, comic books and rock and roll music was going to melt your brain. And of course, the radio and novels and television, everything was going to melt your brain. Well, none of this stuff melts your brain, right? It changes your brain, of course. Every new behavior changes your brain. But you know what? Humans are incredibly good at adapting their behaviors. And so what in the natural course of figuring out the goods and bads of these technologies, we figure out their place. We adapt ourselves and our behaviors to these technologies.
Let me read some comments we've been getting. One from Ron. I change my notification settings almost every day. I go back and forth between silent and vibrate because I wear various different hats, father, husband, mentor, leader. Others require my time and I want to be present when they are engaging me, but it takes practice. A comment from Shirley. Near Ayala is spot on regarding addiction versus habit. Great conversation. Thank you, Shirley. Lojo says, great discussion. Do you think there should be some social media regulations? Also wanting to know about your thoughts on net neutrality. We just did a show on that, but do you think there should be some media regulations based on what you were talking about with smoking?
Yeah, you know, I have to say it's not my area of expertise. I'm not a lawyer, but I do think that there's probably – given what we saw in the latest election, I think that there is room for some kind of regulation. And the regulation I think I'd be for is something that just simply holds this new medium to the standard of other mediums. You know, so if you advertise a political ad on television, you have to say, I'm so-and-so and I approve of this message. Why don't you have to do that on Facebook?
Yeah,
that just seems like common sense, right? That's something that we simply, you know, really should have, that a political ad should be marked as a political ad. And that's something that's very easy to do. So I think I would be for that. What I'm skeptical of is any kind of regulation that tries to make the product less engaging. I think that's probably a fool's errand, right? To say this is addictive, we should make it stop. That's probably not realistic. And frankly, don't hold your breath, right? It's going to take a long time. Facebook's not suddenly going to say, let's make this product less good, because you cannot separate what makes a product fun to use and engaging with what makes it potentially addictive. There's no way to separate the two.
That is Nir Eyal, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. He blogs at nearandfar.com, and he has worked as a business consultant, and he is working on a book about how to help all of us live with and not feel overwhelmed by all the gadgets and devices that are in our lives. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us about the gadgets that you live with and how you live with them. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You have also worked with video game designers, and video games are fascinating. I'm pretty terrible at them, probably more about my age than anything else. But you've written about game designers and this compulsive loop that they create. How does that work?
All right. So it's the same basic hook that we see in all sorts of habit-forming products. I don't work with that industry anymore. That's my pedigree. So I learn many of these techniques from working in that industry. And what I learned was that these techniques weren't really described in any way that was approachable to the rest of us. And so that's really why I wrote Hooked, was being years in that video game industry, that, you know, video game designers are experts at understanding how to change user behavior. And in many circumstances, by the way, you know, a lot of folks don't know this, but, you know, many games today, particularly the ones produced by indie studios, are really art. I mean, they are unbelievably engaging and life-affirming and enhancing and pleasurable. They're fantastic.
And complicated,
and they are a real art form. Now, of course, there's other games which I don't condone the use of, and I will not work for. Some of them have tried to bring me on as a consultant, and I unequivocally won't work for them. And these games are the ones that prey upon whales. Whales is the industry term for people, the 1% of users who account for about 99% of the revenue.
Oh.
And this is, you know, many.
What does whales mean?
In the sea, huge client, a huge customer. And we see whale type industries across many different industries, not just gaming. You know, casinos also, they care about the whales. They don't care about the people who come into Las Vegas and, you know, gamble on a bachelor bachelorette party. Where they really make their money is the people who sit in their chairs all day and all night and can't leave until they run out of all their money. The addicts, the whales. And those are the kind of industries that I think are unethical, because if you know someone is addicted, And I'm talking about the clinical definition of addiction, not the term that we throw around kind of when we say, you know, a video game is addictive. No, I'm talking about the games and the products that are designed to keep people playing even when the maker knows that the user is addicted. Mm-hmm. I think that's unethical. And I wrote an article in The Atlantic around how we need what's called a use and abuse policy, that companies need to have a policy that says, look, if we know that someone is using a product to the extent that they may suffer from an addiction, right? Give me some kind of number. Is it 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week? What's the magic number that triggers a little notification that says, hey, we see you're using this product to the extent that may be that you have trouble with this, right? You may be using this product too much. Can we help, right? Can we help you disconnect? The good news is that, you know, a brewery can't do that. Right. Mm-hmm. If you make booze, you don't know who's overusing your product. You don't know who the alcoholics are. The silver lining of all this data that's being collected about us today is that if companies wanted to do something about this, they could. Right. The
Facebook, because they know who we are.
They
right?
know how much we use. Now, let me put this in perspective. You know, very few people are using a product like Facebook, you know, 40, 50 hours a week. In fact, the average Facebook user uses Facebook for 34 minutes a day. Right.
So is that right?
Yeah. Meanwhile, Nielsen tells us that the average American watches 5 hours of television a day. But, you know, we're not having a conversation about how television is addictive. We're talking about Facebook because it's new and different and people are making a lot of money on it. But the good news is that if they wanted to do something about addiction, they have the data. And so that's what I'm proposing, is that companies and many of these companies would be fine. Right. I don't think Facebook would actually suffer much by letting those few people who are really overdoing it, giving them the opportunity to disconnect or to moderate their use. Some companies can't do that, right? So some companies that look for the whales and are predicated solely on maximizing revenue from those whales, they would go out of business. So some gaming companies, a lot of gambling companies, they don't care about the casual user. They're really all about finding and frankly exploiting the whales.
Well, let's take a very short break, another very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Nir Eyal. He is a business consultant. He blogs at Near and Far. We are talking about technology, living with, using the devices that we use, and how to think about the problems, the potential problems of addiction. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Nir Eyal, and he wrote a book a few years ago titled Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and he has worked with companies designing irresistible products, how they actually work on us psychologically. He's also blogged about how consumers, and of course that would be the rest of us, including himself, can manage our daily digital distractions, things like information overload, also learn to control the gadgets rather than be controlled by them. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. You came to this country as a little boy. Your family came from Israel. And you have written about the fact that when you were an adolescent, you had some weight issues. You were overweight. You said obese.
It's true.
And you were a C&D student, something, frankly, I can relate to. But nonetheless, you were not a particularly good student. But you did something about this.
Yeah, I think this is kind of why I got into this field in the first place. I remember food feeling as if it controlled me at a certain point in my life. And I remember my mom taking me into the doctor's office, and I distinctly have this, you know, I can picture it like it was yesterday. The doctor points to this chart on the wall and says, here's normal, here's overweight, and here's you.
Wow. So, I have to say, you're a thin person.
Today I am within the normal range. But I think that started my fascination with what is it about products that is so influential, right? What is it about media and commercials? You know, I grew up in an age where every Saturday you woke up early and you watched commercials until your parents woke up, basically commercials. There was a little bit of cartoons intermixed with the commercials, but it was a lot of advertising for sugary cereals and junk food, et cetera. And so I became really fascinated with how these products persuade us. And I think that's what started me along this road.
Well, it sounds like you're saying it wasn't a matter of willpower, that you had to figure out something to substitute for what food meant to you at the time.
Right. So I think today the way I manage my weight, and it's still a daily struggle, is very similar to how I manage technology, is that the price of progress, the price of this age we live in, when we take a step back, so much of what is in our world today is absolutely profoundly miraculous. Yeah. More people die today for the first time in history from diseases of overconsumption than underconsumption. I mean, think about that for a minute. Fewer people die of starvation for the first time in history than die of these diseases that are caused by excess. Now, that's terrible that we have those diseases at all, but we live in an age where shortage is no longer the leading problem, that excess is the leading problem. We live in an age where we have unlimited amounts of information and entertainment at our beck and call, and for free. I mean, I think about the money I wasted on DVDs and CDs and tape cassettes and records, and all that media is now for free on my Amazon Echo device anytime I want. So it's an amazing age we live in. The price of that progress is that we have a lot of opportunity for distraction. Just as with food, you know, it's no secret that food has been engineered to be tasty, to be delicious, whether that's on the
fat, sugar, salt,
fat, all sugar, those, and salt, exactly. Yeah. But even more on a molecular level, I mean, the millennia of creating fruit, for example, that is food that is, you know, we think of as natural, but of course the food we eat today is nothing like what our ancestors ate. Even a grain of rice looks nothing like what it did 10,000 years ago. It's been engineered through cultivation, let alone the way a chef might take those raw ingredients and make something like a chocolate croissant, which is my downfall, which is incredibly hard to resist. Now, do I want to live in a world without chocolate croissants? Of course I don't. And I also don't want to live in a world, frankly, without booze and cigarettes. It means that it requires a higher level of deliberation, of thinking about what kind of rules you're going to set for yourself. So some rules that I set for myself, I use this technique that I call progressive extremism, that I take small steps, but I take them forever. Right. And what that means is, for example, one of the things that you can do if you want to prevent a behavior, if you want to stop a bad habit, is to remove the triggers. It's probably the most effective thing you can do. So it's very
like
hard.
Like the ashtrays you were talking about?
Like the ashtrays, for example. And on a food, from the food front, it's very hard to lose weight with donuts in the house. So one of the things that I had to do was I used to drink a lot of soda. I had to set a rule that I would not have soda in the house. Right. Yeah, I could have diet soda. And I could have soda outside the house. But I took that tiny baby step of saying no longer in the house. I removed that trigger from my house so that I wouldn't be tempted. And that did a lot of good. Same goes with our devices, right? We talked about removing notifications. A very simple thing we can do so that your phone isn't constantly buzzing and beeping at you. That's one thing we can do. Same type of behavior.
I was thinking as you were describing the world that we live in, and not only is there excess for so many people, but there's also choice, or this sometimes what it feels like an illusion of choice. But, I painted a part of our house and there were maybe 150 blues we could have chosen from. I mean, we chose one, but how do you decide what color blue do you want in your life?
Right. Well, the good news is that you're not the only one that has this problem. And so what we're seeing now, I mean, there's a lot of talk these days about how the robots and the artificial intelligence are taking over our jobs and there'll be no more jobs left. And this explosion of different technologies has created all these different options that drive us crazy, like 42 shades of blue, et cetera.
Yeah, 142.
142 shades of blue. Well, the good news is that this is where humans are really good. And so what we're seeing is a rise of jobs to help us decide. Right, sometimes assisted by technology, but folks who are specially trained, so to speak, to help us make these sort of decisions. And with this, what we call the gig economy, these people can find work easier than ever, and their services are cheaper than ever. So we're going to see more and more of these jobs that help us focus, help us create sometimes less choice by giving us an expert opinion. And we're seeing the rise of what I call attention retention devices.
Attention retention.
Exactly. Attention retention devices. These technologies that are custom built to tune out distraction. So I mentioned the Forest app, for example. example, this app that I use every time I need to do some focused writing time. With one click, it makes it more difficult for me to distract myself. There's another app I use on my desktop called Self Control that whenever I write or I want to focus on something, it disconnects my internet. In fact, Jonathan Franzen, the American novelist, he actually writes on a laptop where he has disabled the Wi-Fi connection.
Right? So there are no distractions.
Exactly. There's no distractions. Well, this is where we are more powerful than the big tech companies, right? If you turn off your notifications, if you decide I don't want to use these technologies during certain times of the day, there's nothing they can do to break that barrier.
Let me get Rick from Warminster to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Very interesting interview.
Thank you.
My sensing also, whether it's technology and instant messaging, or as you say, excess of food, in the last 20 years, there's been the death of anticipation. You used to have to wait for a letter in the mailbox. You used to have to wait for a phone call. You used to have to wait for things. And I think that pause had you savor whatever it was. And I think we've lost that anticipation. And it's all jammed up, and we have a cacophony of information and noise.
Well, that's fascinating. What do you think about that, Nir?
I think it's a great point. That insight, I think we can leverage to our advantage, in fact. So here's a trick that I use. So I found that many times when I was on the web, I would see an interesting article. And as you describe, I just did it, right? Instant gratification, interesting headline. People call it clickbait. Read the article. Well, this resulted in some pretty bad consequences, right? I'd want to sit down and do some serious work, and 45 minutes later, I was still clicking and scrolling through articles online because, of course, you know, they are designed to get you to do that. So instead, what I did was I built in anticipation in a way. What I did is I use a Chrome extension on my browser, which is free. It's an app called Pocket. It doesn't cost anything.
I'm writing all this down, by the way, but go ahead.
So what happens with Pocket, I don't have any interest in this company. I just love it, and I use it a lot. Every time you see an interesting article, you click this little button on your browser, and it's saved to an app on your phone so that you can read it later. Now, what I do then is I use a technique called temptation bundling. Temptation bundling is when you take something that's rewarding and you like, and you bundle it, you couple it with something that you don't really like. So what do? I use this amazing app, which will literally read to me these articles while I'm in the gym. And that becomes my reward. So I've delayed the reward. I've moved the anticipation so that it becomes a motivator to do something I didn't really want to do. So not only do I get to go to the gym, but I also save the time wasted on the web.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And as Rick was talking, I was thinking about Amazon. You know, and everything is this fast, sometimes same-day delivery, which seems kind of insane when you think about it.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And it's interesting. You know, I think Amazon is one of these companies that I profile in the book, Hooked, that really are masters of habit formation. I mean, Amazon's competition is no longer Walmart. It's not Target. Amazon's competition is the to-do list. They want to make it easier from a cognitive standpoint for you to just order on the app or tell the Amazon Echo what to buy or push the dash button. Have you seen these dash buttons, these little tiny buttons that they want you to stick where you would keep your toilet paper or your kitty litter, that you just push the button and it's on its way to you?
No.
Right? Absolutely.
That exists?
And not only does it exist, I remember the day it was revealed. It was revealed on April 1st and everybody thought it was an April Fool's joke. And I said, no. Amazon knows exactly what they're doing. They want to make it as easy as possible for you to reorder because that's their competition. It's the to-do list.
When does that become Big Brother?
You know, it's a great question. I think it's something we need to be aware of. I think it's part of being media literate around what information you're giving these companies. I think we need to be aware. We need to be aware of what harm these companies might be doing to us. For me, it's a little bit difficult to figure out why Amazon, knowing, you know, how frequently I order decaf coffee, how that's Big Brother at this point.
Right. But,
you know, but
if they know about your coffee, they might know about other things.
Could
more,
be.
More private things.
They could. And you know, there's probably some purchases you don't want to make on Amazon. Could be. You know, I think we're moving to a future where Amazon gets so good with this data that they won't even wait for you to order it.
Oh, they'll just anticipate
that you
need it.
They'll just send it to you. Exactly. There will come. I mean, already I use, you know, this Amazon Subscribe and Save, where there's a bunch of items in my cart that I use, you know, every few months, coffee and a water filter, et cetera, that just comes to my doorstep. Frankly, I love it. I mean, that's incorporating this fourth step in the hook called the investment phase, where by giving these companies data, by giving them content, by giving them more information to these companies, they are improving the product with use. And if you think about it, that's amazing. You know, back in the day when Henry Ford made the Model T, you could get it famously in any color as long as it was black, because it was very difficult to retool the factory to make it in any other color. Well, today, you are making Facebook and Amazon and Twitter and Instagram, you are making these products in real time based on your data. And that's what's really special about these technologies.
I mean, that is very specialized, obviously. Right. They know us. They know apparently know what we like or
exactly.
And a lot of what we like.
And if you logged into my Facebook account, it actually wouldn't be interesting to you, right? It would be full of stuff that's been customized to me. And that's really amazing.
That's Nir Eyal. And we're talking about the devices that we live with. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. And you can check out his blog, Nir, that's N-I-R, and far.com. And you can join us on Radio Times at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I'm Marty Moscowane. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I do want to go back to, we were talking about focus, the ability, I mean, literally our brain's ability to both ignore some things and pay attention to other things. You also say that we lose our ability to focus as we age. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of research around cognitive declines that occur as we age. And in some ways, young people are better capable of focusing, believe it or not, even though it looks like young folks today are distracted by their devices. But there are some cognitive declines that occur with age. The good news is that there's an explosion of technology today that can help us with that problem. You know, I mentioned I like to invest in products that use habit-forming technology for good, right, and use the principles in my book to help people form healthy habits. One of the companies that I just recently invested in that I'm excited about is called FocusMate. FocusMate is fascinating. So what's happened is there's a lot of folks who find they need to do work, they need to focus on a particular task, but they're just too distracted. And they used to go into the office where somebody could see, you know, if you were reading a magazine at your desk, if you were reading Sports Illustrated or something, everybody could see that, and that was clearly unacceptable. Well, today you could be on your computer looking at ESPN or something and appear just as busy even if you're slacking off.
Sure.
So what FocusMate does, it's an online website where you can go and book time with another person, sometimes on the other face of the earth, where that you can work together, you can co-work at the same time on a particular project, and you see them through your camera, and they see you. They don't see what's on your screen, but you spend time on a focused task for a set period of time, and it's amazing. Just the fact that someone else is working on a task with you at the same time is very effective.
You've also written about interesting research about when you feel like you can't focus. Just the act of closing your eyes.
Mm.
I mean, it's a way of, I guess, decluttering
right.
our visual space. By closing our eyes, that actually helps us.
Exactly. We know that visual clutter is very distracting, right? If we look at many times when I work with folks on clearing digital distraction, I ask to look at their phone home screen or their laptop home screen, and it is just a mess, right? Of files and notifications and pings and dings. So that's a step that, you know, literally can take you 15, 20 minutes. Clear out that digital distraction. Clear out all those what I call external triggers. Even the files and the apps and the notifications, those have got to be cleared out, because the more visual stimulation we have, the less likely we are to be able to focus on our task. One step further, even a cell phone, there's a research study that found that even a cell phone next to us turned off makes us less able to focus.
Just because we think, well,
just the presence.
Maybe there's something
exactly.
there.
Exactly.
Right?
Just the cognitive load of thinking about what might be there.
Well, we're back to intermittent reinforcement, right? Nir Eyal, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. This was fun.
Fun for us as well. And again, you can check out his blog, nearandfar.com. And again, wrote a book a couple of years ago, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. And he's speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at WHYY. That's it for today's edition of the show. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer, and the show is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.